Welcome, our Mini Med Pods team. Myself, Simran, and I'm here with Xiao. We're back on track again with another episode today. So today, what we're going to be covering is fluid assessments, a very interesting, unique topic that kind of, I guess, flows through many different systems. And today, we're going to be guided by Xiao, who's going to be going through fluid assessments with us.
Thank you so much, Simran. Welcome, guys, once again. So let's just start off with a chat, Simran. I'm wondering, what's your experiences with fluid assessments?
I get to see a lot of fluid assessments now because I'm currently on my renal rotation. So it's very, very common in hospital. And you actually realize that you end up doing it for most patients who are in hospital, regardless of what reason they're there. So yeah, very common.
That's right. And I think that was my experience too. That's sort of the reason why I sort of decided to start with fluid assessments. That's because I remember when I was in third year, and it was probably my third or fourth week, and a registrar had come up to me and say, "Oh, hey, would you like to do a fluid assessment on this patient that we have here and then come back with your findings?" And I just remembered thinking to myself, "Oh, I know what she's asking, but I have absolutely no idea how to go about one." So
Yeah.
I thought, let's do a podcast on one and hopefully upskill everyone who's listening to us today. So thank you so much for listening to us. Like I said, fluid assessments are really common and it's an essential skill for basically all doctors. I even think we did used it for pediatrics last year. And you're going to continue using
Oh,
it
we did.
because,
Yeah.
as Simran's in renal right now, she's using it in her medical specialty, and you also use it in surgical specialties, especially in anything to do with general surgery because of bowel obstructions. Bowel obstructions play around with your fluid balance quite a bit. And it's also really important
Yeah.
in acute settings as well as subacute settings. Look, our parents always said water is really important. And when you're in hospital, that's exactly the same thing. We've got to make sure that our patients are not fluid overloaded or dehydrated.
Gotta find a sweet
So
balance.
that's right, the sweet balance. The fluid assessment I'll be going over today, or the examination rather, will assess for both hyper too high or hypo too low volemia. So let's start with brainstorming some causes. So I have the way I approach fluid statuses is you always have to think about, oh, what could be the potential underlying disease or the underlying condition. So let's start with dehydration. Simran, do you sort of have any ideas how you split this up or any way to pick your battles?
Yeah, so I think of three different battles. So the way I classify is I think about the different ways in which a person could become hypovolemic, so dehydrated. One classification is probably intake. So poor intake of fluids could lead to dehydration because we're not replenishing the fluids that we're losing on a daily basis. When you're thinking, okay, how much is their intake? The other classification is whether there's increased output. So is there more fluid that's leaving the body than would be normal? And third, spacing. That's the other category, which is basically when fluid accumulates in the extracellular fluid. So it's not actually where it's supposed to be. It kind of goes somewhere else and just doesn't come back. And so I'm thinking, okay, what are different ways in which, fluid could then go into third spaces? So my three categories would be reduced intake or increased output, or third spacing, and there could be a combination of all three of these as well.
That's true. That's true. I know medicine's never quite black and white. It's always a mixture of two or three causes. What
That's
about
why they say it's
high?
art.
Yes, it's an art, not a science. What about fluid overload, hypervolemia?
Hypervolemia, yep. So fluid overload, I'm thinking I usually divide it into two categories. So I'm like, okay, is there excessive intake, so increased intake of fluid that then the body is not able to clear at the same time, like enough, or I guess in enough in like yeah, so you basically had too much fluid in your body, or decreased output, so just fluid retention. So you're drinking water, or drinking or taking in fluids, but you're not able to lose it. Or you're just drinking too much and your body's just not able to get rid of it in time.
Great. Thank you so much. So let's move on to how do we even approach to a fluid exam if you've been asked to do one? So your registrars come up to you. This is definitely taking from personal experience. Your registrars ask you to perform a fluid exam on the patient. What do you do next? So the first thing I would encourage everyone to do is to gain as much information as you can. I know as a third year, we're sort of thinking, okay, we've just got to do history and exam and just, smash it out of the ball, smash it out of the park, sorry. But I think if you're in a hospital and this patient's already been admitted, you're going to be able to gain so much information from the admission files as well as the progress notes. So hit those first, gain as much information as you can. So obviously gain patient details, make sure you know the patient's name. It's very awkward when you go in and you're just like, hi, person. Just make it a little bit more personable. And then look at things like, what are the possible reasons that my registrar has asked for this fluid exam? So look up their medical history. Can you find that cause of the dehydration or their fluid overload? Are they on any medications? So things like diuretics can actually help fluid overload, but we also know that if it's given too hard, too fast, it can actually cause dehydration. Other things like if they're already fluid overloaded, but someone's giving them IV fluids, well, then we need to start thinking if the fluid overload state has been caused by us. So that's something to think about as well. Then you want to look if the patient has ever complained of symptoms. So some symptoms of hypervolemia, fluid overload, is things like shortness of breath, apnea, PND, ascites, swelling in the legs. And like, fair enough, they're probably not going to tell you, hi, doctor, I have apnea. But you can elicit those questions by saying, do you feel uncomfortable lying down because you're struggling to breathe? Similarly, with ascites, you can ask them if they've noticed that they've ballooned in their belly more so than what it's possible when they eat, what's more, more possible than gaining weight. Like, this is completely unusual gaining weight. Then you can also ask for symptoms associated with hypovolemia, so not enough fluid. So things like bleeding, vomiting, diarrhea, those are really common causes of a dehydrated state. And also, if a person is really dehydrated or they don't have enough intravascular fluid, then they might feel lightheaded or dizzy, especially when they're going from lie to sit or sit to stand. Other information, if you can grab it, is look at their eating status and their drinking status. So if you're on a surgical ward, do have a look whether they're nail by mouth or what kind of diet they're on. Also, if they're on a cardiology or a renal ward, you want to have a look whether they're on any fluid restrictions. And also have a look again for IV therapy. Fluid balance charts and daily weight charts are going to be your best friends. They're probably the most objective way and really easy way to monitor your patient's fluid status. And then, your bread and butter, have a look at their observations. Okay. Now you've got all that information. One thing to add is, let's say there's information here that's missing. What you can do is you can change that into your history questions. So let's say you're missing some symptoms. Well, then that's easy. Now you know when you go in to the patient and you want to have a chat with them, ask whatever you think is missing and gain as much information that way. Okay. Now that you've done your information collection outside the patient, you've done a bit of a history to make a more complete picture, let's start the exam. So, I'm going to have a discussion with Simran if you would like
Yeah,
about
for
the
sure.
examination, and we can sort of bounce back and forth as to what to do and why we do stuff. So, starting off with general inspection, have a look at the environment. Look for the IV line, any drain tubes, catheter, nasogastric tube, vomit or sputum bags, and also look for an O2 delivery device. Then having a look at the patient, you want to make sure that they're stable, meaning that their observations, I guess, are stable, but also they themselves look stable. They're alert, they're oriented, you can also have a look at their position. So if they're lying down flat, they're probably not going to have a lot of fluid in their lungs. If they're nice and comfortable, they're probably also quite well themselves. Have a look at their color, whether they're too pale or they're too red. Simran, do you look at people's color when you're on the renal ward?
Yes, we do actually. And the reason is because, so with kidneys in general, for patients who have chronic kidney disease, one of the complications that come with chronic kidney disease is anemia. And so a lot of these patients would actually have signs of anemia, like pallor, like looking pale, having conjunctival pallor. So it is very important. And I think just color itself also kind of gives you an indication of health as well. So if a person is well and healthy, they'll be well perfused. But I think someone is unwell, they'll probably look a bit pale, a bit drowsy. And I think it also indicates perfusion as well. So if there's good perfusion through the blood vessels, and they'll have, like, you know, good color. So it definitely gives a lot of information, not just from a renal perspective, but an overall health perspective.
Yeah, that's right. That's really good. And you can also decide if they're ambulant and if they're able to grab one of those weighing chairs, and you can actually weigh them there and then. Moving on to hands and arms. So the really popular ones, I'm going to start from peripheral and then sort of work more to proximal. So start with a capillary refill, and normal is less than 2 seconds. Anything greater means that they have poor peripheral perfusion. And look, Simran was talking about it just now. You can also have a look at the color of their face. But if they have poor peripheral perfusion, then I'm sort of thinking, well, blood's not really getting there, and it might be a pump failure. So as indicated by congestive heart failure, or it could be because they don't have enough blood inside their intravascular fluid, so suggestive of hypovolemia. Other things you can do is give them a pinch on the back of their hand. Have a go on yours right now, and you're going to realize, hopefully, that your one bounces back as soon as you let go. So that kind of spring is what we call normal. It springs back immediately. If the skin returns slowly, then that could be an indication of dehydration or too little fluid in the body. And this is described as decreased skin turgor. Next, I sort of go to the pulse. So I group all the observations together. So because once I'm taking the pulse, I may as well do them all in one shot. So with pulse, think about the rate. Tachycardia is often a sign of dehydration. Also think about the quality. So strength is really important. And that's because it can either give you an idea as to maybe an underlying disease. So for example, a bounding pulse is associated with aortic regurgitation, which often is a cause of congestive heart failure. Or a weak pulse might be a sign that there's not enough intravascular fluid, meaning they're dehydrated. BP is also a really good sign. It's also quite straightforward. Low BP is a sign of low fluid, and high BP is a sign of high fluid. You know how I was talking about dizziness and lightheadedness? Well, also don't forget to do a postural BP. So the easiest one is lie to sit. So take a BP whilst you're lying down, take a BP whilst you're sitting up. And if their systolic blood pressure is more than 20 different, then they've basically got a reason as to why, well, they've got postural hypotension. Okay, next, temperature. So fever, it can be a cause of hypovolemia, and that's because it might be their septic, and people who are very sick and septic don't tend to have as good as a thirst sort of reflex. And also, if you're feeling really unwell, you're probably not thinking about that kind of stuff. You're more focused on trying to make yourself better. Then respirate and O2 saturations. Well, if you're breathing really fast and your saturations are low, start thinking, Perhaps maybe there's some lung pathology and start thinking about pulmonary edema as well. Moving on to head and neck. So head and neck tend, you can look at the eyes, the conjunctiva and the mucous membranes, and those ones are really, really famous quick observation signs for hypo to low volemia. JVP is really important. JVP basically indicates how much blood is going back to the right atrium. So the way you can do this is you lie your patient down and then raise the back and chest bit of the bed to about 45 degrees. Get them to look left, and you're going to have a look at their right internal jugular vein. And what you're looking for is you're looking for that little double flicker to be around 3 to 4 centimeters at the level of the sternum. We can go through in depth when we start talking about the cardio exam, but a normal is between 3 to 4 centimeters. You might find that very, very young patients, you won't even be able to see their JVP because it's below the clavicle, meaning it's less than 3. That usually is okay. Then looking at the carotid pulse as well as the catheter. Sorry, Saren, it looks like you wanted to say something.
I actually want to say also one more tip. You can also use a flashlight when you're looking for the JVP because sometimes you can't really see the double flicker with the normal light. So just have a flashlight and you'll pull you up to see like the double flicker.
Yes, that's a really good tip and trick. I've definitely seen it in the cardiology ward, and it does make it a lot easier. Moving on to the chest, you've done peripheral capillary refill on the fingers, so now check the central capillary refill and see how well the heart is perfusing the trunk. So again, less than 2 centimeters is normal. If you're wondering how do I test this, pop your hand over your sternum, press down until your skin blanches, and then lift up your thumb and then count how many seconds it takes for your skin color to return to normal. Then palpating for thrills, which usually happens over murmurs, cardiac murmurs, especially the quite severe ones. You can actually feel the thrill as well as heaves. So heaves is indicative of cardiomegaly, and cardiomegaly is associated with congestive heart failure. Next, palpate for the apex beat. Make sure it is in its correct space, which I believe is the fourth intercostal space at the mid-clavicular line. Then percuss the lungs. Percussion really gives you a lot of information. It can tell you whether the lungs could be consolidated. And if they are consolidated bilaterally, then what you've got to do next is basically auscultate and listen to what kind of funny sounds is going to be in there. So auscultate the lungs. If they're fine crackles bilaterally, then you probably need to start thinking, oh, is this pulmonary edema? Do I need a chest X-ray? Do I need to look for more information? Whenever you auscultate the lungs, don't forget to auscultate the heart to some extent. So, auscultating the heart, we're thinking fluid overload. So, in this case, what are the heart sounds of congestive heart failure? Well, the heart sounds is the third heart sound or any murmurs. Those could be indicative of congestive heart failure. Then, now that you're already sort of around the back area, have a feel of the sacrum and see if there's any pitting edema. And this is really important for patients who are on their back a lot because they're not going to actually pull their fluid on their legs, which is what we normally think of there. Instead, because they're on their back, they'll pull it around their sacrum. Okay, moving on to abdomen. So, inspect. The abdomen firstly for any distension, then percuss all 9 regions. And then, whilst you're doing your percussion, you can also test for ascites. So, there's 2 ways to do this. Do you know what the 2 ways are, Simran?
I know one is, I think it's called shifting dullness.
Perfect.
The other one, I actually don't know.
That's all good. So, Simran, do you want to explain what shifting, how to do shifting dullness?
From memory, what they do is you start from one side. So the patient's lying on their back. You start from one side of the abdomen and you basically just percuss from. So if I'm on the right side of the patient, I'll percuss from left to right, so across the abdomen. And then I'll ask the patient to then roll over towards me on their side. And I'll wait for about 30 seconds, and then I'll percuss the last region that I percussed again to feel for if there's any change in the percussion. So whether it went from dull to not being so dull, in which case I'd be thinking, okay, so when I originally percussed it, there probably was fluid. After waiting 30 seconds, the fluid's probably gone down. And when I percussed it again, it's not as dull. So that's kind of how I remember doing shifting dullness. I can't describe it better. I think if you were to search up a picture, you'll get a good idea of how it's done.
Yes. For examinations, YouTube videos sometimes help a lot too. And the other one is called the fluid thrill or the fluid wave test. That's the one where you get the patient to basically hold the middle of the abdomen. And you do so by basically, if you put your hands together almost as if you're doing a prayer, then you flip it downwards and then you put it on the top of your belly button. That so lightly, that's going to stop the skin from moving. And then what you do is you, as the clinician, pop your hand on both sides of the abdomen. And what you're going to do is from one side, you're going to give a bit of a push, and then your other hand is basically feeling to see if there's any fluid shifting over when you gave the abdomen a bit of a push. You can push it back and forth a couple of times just to confirm your findings. Okay, so that's the abdomen. Now we're going down towards the legs. So legs, the main thing to look for is pitting edema. And I'm sure you know how to do this. Basically, you press a few seconds on, I like to do it over the shin because I think it's very obvious. You know, you're supposed to have a bone underneath it. And if you see it pitting, well, then you've got a positive sign. And pitting edema is related to fluid overload.
Also wanted to add was with pitting edema, when it comes to the legs, you also want to note pitting edema up to what point. So sometimes they might just have pitting edema right at their up to their ankles. So when you are assessing, you want to first start peripherally, so from your feet, and then work your way up, and you want to see up until where that fluid is. So if you say pitting edema up to the knees, it means that there's fluid that's accumulated enough to make it up to the knees. So from the knees down, there's fluid overload.
Yes, that's a good point because it actually gives you an indication of the severity of the fluid overload as well. Yeah, and
Absolutely.
that's potentially one of the best thing about the pitting edema tests because the other tests I would say don't give you as much of an idea as to severity. It only just says yes, this is a positive finding, or no, this isn't.
Yeah.
Okay, and then if you want to, oh, sorry.
I guess JVP could also be a marker of severity too,
Oh
depending on
yes,
like
that's
how
so
high.
true.
Yeah, but I think in
That's
the other
true.
ones it's very subjective, especially with lungs and the heart. Unless you do some imaging, you may not get the, may not be able to identify how severe it is on examination.
That's right. You're right. Yes, JVP also will give you an indication of severity. Okay, lastly, investigations. Simon, would you like to explain what investigations we normally do in a fluid after a fluid exam assessment?
Yeah, so I guess, I mean, we've kind of covered everything really well, like, causes. You do your history examination. So what naturally follows is that, okay, so what next? How else are you going to investigate this to get to your diagnosis? So everything that we're doing right now is just help us figure out what's going on. So investigations, bedside, you want to have like a fluid balance chart that's there for the duration of the patient's admission. And that's just there to see how much fluid is being has a patient taken in, and also how much urine is being and what's their urine output. Weights, so getting daily weights, which you also mentioned. Bedside investigations you can order is a urine, like a urine dipstick. Urine dipstick is good because it can actually show urine, so it basically gives an indication of how well the kidneys are working. And you can detect whether there's any protein or any red blood cells in the actual dipstick, and in which case, if you do detect protein, you can consider doing ordering a urine protein creatinine ratio as well to look for any signs of fluid overload or kidney damage. You can also do a bedside ECG as well to rule out any sort of pathology in the heart. And then bloods, so you can order basic bloods like FBE, UEC, CNP, LFTs, and any additional ones. I think you always do these baseline ones. And then imaging, so you can order a chest X-ray to look at the lungs, an echo, an abdominal ultrasound. You can even order an ultrasound of the kidney, ureter, or bladders if you're worried about any sort of kidney-related pathology. So you can see, okay, if I think this is kidney-related, you want to know whether, you know, where the problem is. So I think it's also like, I think your investigations are very much lined up with your history and your examinations. Because most of the time, if there's a known pathology in the kidneys, you might want to preference doing a kidney ultrasound over an echo. So I guess just knowing that these investigations are available and then knowing which ones are most important and will give the most amount of information.
Awesome. Thank you so much. So I think let's go with a quick summary. And I believe, Simran, you have a fun tip for all of us to end the session.
Yes.
So, quick summary, guys. What do you do when you're asked to do a fluid exam? Firstly, gain as much information as you can from the patient files. Grab their details. Think about the reasons as to why someone or why you've decided to do a fluid exam. Grab their medical history, their medication list. Think about maybe they've complained about some symptoms prior to you seeing them, or what questions you're going to ask them to elicit those symptoms of dehydration and fluid overload. Think about all the other information that you want to know, such as their eating, drinking status, fluid balance chart, daily weights, and their OBS. During the examination, first, start off with your general inspection. Look at the environment, check for any leads, drains, catheters, NG tubes, vomit, or sputum bags around them. Also, see if they're hooked up to any oxygen devices. Check the patient, make sure they're alert, oriented, their positioning, their color, and if you want to, consider performing a Wii. Looking at the hands and arms, check for capillary refill, skin turgor. I like to put my observations here, so look for pulse. Sorry, check pulse, BP, temperature, rest rate, and O2 saturations. Next, head and neck. Look for sunken orbits, conjunctival pallor, and dry mucous membranes, which are indicative of low volume. Check JVP, carotid pulse, and also comment on the character. Moving on to the chest, look for the central capillary refill, palpate for thrills and heaves, as well as the apex beat. Percuss the lungs and auscultate both the heart and lungs. Now that you're at the back of the patient, palpate the sacrum for any pitting edema. Once the patient is lying down, expose the abdomen and inspect for any distension. Percuss and check for ascites, and you may do so by performing the fluid thrill test or shifting dullness. Moving on to the legs, perform a capillary refill and a pitting edema. You may end the exam by thinking through what you would like to order in terms of investigations. Mind you, the investigations are highly guided by your history and exam. But on a general, you probably want to order a fluid balance, weights. You may want to consider a urine dipstick. Then for bloods, order basic bloods, FBE, UEC, CNP, LFTs, and imaging is highly guided by your history and exam. Okay, that's your quick summary for me. So Simran, what is your fun and helpful tip?
Okay, so I was actually really interested in knowing about fluid overload and figuring out what the cause is. And so I actually asked one of my registrars during my renal round, like, you know, how when you look at a patient who's fluid overloaded, just from looking at them, can you tell whether it's coming from, whether this is due to the kidney, the liver, or the heart? Because when you're thinking about fluid overload, these are the three main organs you're thinking about. You're thinking about the heart, whether there's heart failure, so pump failure that's causing fluid overload. Liver, so you're thinking about cirrhosis leading to portal hypertension, which then leads to fluid overload, mainly ascites. Or you're thinking about the kidneys. So maybe the kidneys are undergoing some sort of acute or chronic injury that's then affecting the actual filtering of blood and the removal of fluid. It's the fluids accumulating. And so he had a really interesting way of explaining it. He's like, with kidneys, it's usually due to, or most of the times it could be due to, like they're losing, if there's a lot of kidney damage through the kidneys, usually we don't really filter out proteins. But someone who has some sort of kidney injury may actually lose a lot of protein in their urine. And when you lose a lot of protein, there's actually not enough, like enough of a high oncotic pressure within the blood vessels that actually keeps the fluid within the blood vessels. So a lot of the times, because of the low protein or the hypoalbuminemia that occurs due to kidney injury, that fluid can actually seep out and lead to edema, so pitting edema. And because this affects all of your blood vessels, they're usually going to be fluid overloaded all over. So that includes in their lungs, their JVP, their legs, everywhere. Someone with like a heart-related problem, so for instance, heart failure, it's a pump failure. Because the pump is not working, most of the times the fluid, depending on whether it's right side or left sided, if you've got a left side heart failure, a lot of the fluid will accumulate in the lungs. So they'll primarily have acute pulmonary edema and present with that orthopnea picture where they can't lie flat. They become really short of breath. Versus someone who's got right side heart failure, they'll have a lot of the fluid just pooling in their legs and sometimes also in their tummy. And that's mainly because of the poor pump failure and the fact that gravity will just bring the fluid down. And then someone with liver-related issues like cirrhosis leading to portal hypertension, the first place where the fluid's actually going to go is the tummy. So they're predominantly going to be centrally very, very edematous. So bloating would be probably the first thing you'll notice. So it's very really interesting to kind of get that kind of information. I hope that helps everyone. Also keeping in mind that examination is not everything, but it is very important. Marrying that with the history and asking the relevant questions will give a better idea of what's going on.
Thank you. That was great.
All right, so that literally brings us to the end of our podcast, or this episode, sorry. I hope that this was very informative for you all. I know I learned a lot today from Xiao, so thank you so much, Xiao, for going through the history, the examination, the investigations, and also giving us an overview of the possible causes of fluid overload. So yeah, that's a wrap from us, guys. I just wanted to just give you guys a reminder that we are available if you want to contact us. So we are on Facebook. If you search us, if you search Mini Med Pods, please find us there. Give us a follow. You can even message us if you have any questions or any suggestions for any topics. You can also get in touch with us by email. So our email is minimedpods@gmail.com. I also want to say that we may have made some mistakes during this, or we may not have covered everything. So please feel free to message us and correct us and give us any additional information that you have about any of these topics. We're always happy to learn and make changes. And yeah, well, I hope this we found this, you guys all found this really useful. And I hope you all have a wonderful day. See you
Thank
guys
you
in the next
guys.
episode.
Bye bye.
Bye.